This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For over a year now, the New Horizons space probe has been beaming back photos of Pluto and its moon Charon. Remember seeing the whale's tail for the first time? All these images are revealing details about the geology of the dwarf planet and its moon, and it's also bringing up more questions. One mystery has been why Charon has a wispy red cap at its north pole. Scientists this week may have cracked that question. Here to talk about that and other selected short subjects in science is Rachel Feltman, editor of the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Interesting stuff. What do we know about Charon now that we didn't know before?
So one of the things that scientists spotted during the flyby was, first of all, Charon had a much more interesting surface than they expected. It wasn't this old crater-marked rock. It had a bunch of interesting geology. It had these huge chasms, like the bigger than the Grand Canyon. And one of the things they noticed is that it had this bright red spot on its north pole. And the intriguing thing was that this red spot looked an awful lot like the color of Pluto. And they thought maybe because Pluto had this wispy atmosphere they had just discovered and didn't really have the gravitational strength to hold on to that atmosphere, maybe Charon grabbed some of it and was getting the molecules to, you know, paint itself red. But they weren't sure whether that could actually occur. They didn't know whether there were places on Charon that was cold, that were cold enough to actually trap the atmosphere. But this new study found that during Pluto and Charon's orbit, there are these periods of 100-year winters where either pole will be plunged in total darkness for a century. And during that time, the temperature is around minus 430 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's like Game of Thrones on Pluto.
Right, exactly. Which is cold enough for Charon's poles to hold on to frozen methane. So basically, what's happening is that these macromolecules called tholins, you know, make Pluto red, but some of the same methane that is the source of those tholins gets sent over to Charon. As it escapes out into space, Charon captures some of it. And in the winter, the poles are cold enough to hold on to it. In the spring, when it's sunlight, they sublimate back into gas. But some of the heavier macromolecules stay on Charon, turn into tholins. Over the course of millions of years, it has turned the moon red.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
So simple an explanation. How much longer is New Horizons going to be flying by Pluto and Charon?
Well, you know, the flyby itself, you know, was really quick. It was, you know, over in just a few hours. They do still have a few more months, I think, of sending back data from the flyby. And the mission has officially been extended so that in 2019, it's actually going to be beaming back data about another more mysterious Kuiper Belt object.
Yeah, we're waiting. Speaking of mysterious things, there's a new interactive map released this week, a map of the entire galaxy. Cool.
Yeah, so it's the most complete sky map ever, and it's from the Gaia Space Telescope. It's 1 year into its observation phase. It's orbiting the sun about a million miles farther out than Earth is, and it has these two telescopes that together power a billion-pixel camera. And what it does is it just scans these billion stars over and over again, more than 70 times a star. And right now, it has precisely mapped the positions and trajectories of 2 million of those stars. So the sky map we got this week was just those 2 million, and the rest of the billion are probably coming sometime in 2017. What's really cool is that they released all of the data because there is just so much that the team involved can't possibly sift through all of it. So people can go online. The BBC had this great anecdote about school children teaching the reporters how to use the database. And while they were showing them, they found a supernova.
No kidding.
Yeah,
no
really.
Kidding.
Because, again,
those kids
just
find the darndest thing.
So there's so much stuff in there. So people should definitely, you know, take a crack at that. And the hope is that by getting these more accurate star distances, we can figure out some things we don't know about the expansion of the universe, about the behavior of dark matter, and also possibly discover some new planets, because we'll probably see some of those stars wobbling because of the planets orbiting them.
Yeah, because we know there's a lot of dark matter there, but we don't know what it is.
Right.
So, wow. That's cool. Your last story is about crows, right?
Yes.
We've always heard that they can use tools. We've seen them like pick up sticks and use them for stuff like that. But not all crows are crafty, turns out.
Well, so a lot of crows can learn to use tools. But so far, until this week, there had only been one species of crow that was an innate tool user, which means even if you don't teach hatchlings how to use sticks as tools, they'll figure it out. There's just, it's something innate that they've evolved to do. And researchers have now found a second species of crow that does this, the Hawaiian crow. And it was really cool. They did it by basically just looking for crows that had the physical characteristics that would lend themselves most to picking up sticks. They have these really straight beaks and very large binocular fields of vision. And sure enough, when they went after that, you know, optimal stick-using crow, they found that they do have innate tool use. If you take the hatchlings away from their parents, they will still learn to use sticks to get food out of the ground. And the other really interesting and sad thing is that these animals are extinct in the wild. There are only 109 of them left in one facility in Hawaii. And so basically we came close to never knowing that they had evolved this really rare ability.
Are they any thoughts about increasing the population or putting them out in the wild? Or?
Well, you know, they are, you know, the facility that they live in is trying to build the population back up. But, you know, 109 is, it was barely large enough for the researchers to even do a real study on them. So it's definitely going to be a long time before that species is, you know, not endangered.
I guess they once did. It must have existed in the wild, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of scary to have them all in one spot. You know, when you think that maybe some disease could come by and they're all together and one kind of...
That's true. That'd be, I don't want to think about that.
No, let's not. Let's think good thoughts as we say goodbye. Always good to have you.
Thanks, Ira.
Rachel Feltman, editor of the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog with us today. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. You know how it is these days when you really need to be in two places at once, or you need to sit and wait for something to happen in place A while you'd really like to be in place B. Well, why not send your telepresence robot? Your what? Well, here to explain it is IEEE Spectrum's Evan Ackerman, who tried it out, but he didn't just send his robot to the 3 p.m. staff meeting. He sent it to the zoo to hang out with family members. And he joins us to talk about the good and bad of letting a telepresence robot do the walking. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Ira. Great to talk with you again.
Tell us what a telepresence robot is for people who don't have one.
So this telepresence robot is called Double. It's basically some wheels with a pole sticking up out of it. And on top of that pole is a case with an iPad in it. And you can log into this iPad from any computer with internet anywhere in the world, and you've got full control over the robot, and you get a video feed of everything the robot sees while your face takes up the whole screen of the iPad on top so that people can see you and talk to you at the same time.
So let's be clear about this. So when they gave you this robot, this trip to the zoo is not what the robot was designed for, right?
Not at all. This is an indoor robot. It's designed to be used where you have really good Wi-Fi. The company makes it specifically for places like offices and schools, and it works great in places like that. But if you have an iPad with this LTE cellular connection, it can technically work just about anywhere. So we wanted to try it out and see how well it does outside.
Let's talk about then what's the good news about this, the good thing.
The good news is that it works outside. I took it to the zoo in Oregon, and I wandered around with it and saw the elephants and talked to people. And it really worked pretty well. It wasn't perfect all the time, but it was definitely usable, which was a lot better than I was expecting.
So what kinds of things did you do at the zoo with it?
The most fun was just wandering around and having people who had never seen a robot like this interact with me. Like, I was at home in Maryland, and my family's out in Oregon, so I was talking to people in Oregon just like I was there, and I was explaining to them, like, look, I'm just sitting at home about 3,000 miles away from you, but I'm here to see the elephants too.
And did people come to accept that it was you and on the screen there?
It was funny because a lot of people... I had my brother with me just to make sure that, you know, I didn't accidentally run into anyone. And a lot of people just kind of talked to him because they didn't realize that I was on the other end of this thing. But once they did, and once kind of they got over that initial novelty, it was just like having a conversation, like I was right there.
Did you come to think of the robot as physically being you? Did you sort of meld with the robot?
I did a little bit, you know, and it's slightly unnerving at times, because when my brother wasn't right there minding me, I kind of had this sense of, okay, there's this robot that's, you know, thousands of miles away from me, and it's my body, kind of, but at the same time, someone could just pick it up and run off with it, and I wouldn't be able to do anything. So it's a little bit weird.
You could scream, I guess, help.
That's about it, though, yeah.
So what's the bad thing here?
Oh, the bad thing is that it doesn't really work as well as maybe it should, and that's not the fault of the robot. It's because we don't have the kind of wireless infrastructure yet. You know, when 5G shows up and we have a lot more bandwidth, this is going to work great. But at the moment, it can be a little bit trying sometimes when your signal drops out and you kind of realize there's this robot that's off doing something. And I don't know what it's doing, but it's doing something.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens. So what do you think the future of these robots is?
I'm really excited for the future of telepresence. Once we get this wireless infrastructure, you'll be able to take robots like these anywhere. And I'm imagining that, you know, at some point, there'll be places where you can rent them. So you could just decide like, hey, I want to wander around Singapore today. And you just, you know, get off the couch, get on the computer and log in, and suddenly you're in a robot and you can go explore Singapore. And it's way easier than flying. And I'm not saying it's as good as being there, but you can do it from home and it's cheap. So why not?
I'm going to give it a shot. So thank you for taking time to be with us today.
No problem. Thanks, Ira.
Good luck with your robot. Evan Ackerman, the contributing editor of the IEEE Spectrum. And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about, for the next 3 weeks, we're going to be celebrating the legacy of the Golden Record. And we're asking you, what would you include on that updated Golden Record? We're collecting your suggestions at sciencefriday.com/Golden Record. In 3 weeks, we'll present your revamped records right here on the show. So go to our website and participate. We'll be right back to talk with Andrean and Fran Drake about the record after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in 1977, I had just finished interviewing Carl Sagan about his latest book, The Dragons of Eden. We walked back to my office to chat, and we sat down. He asked me what projects I was working on. I mentioned in passing that I was collecting natural sounds, like thunder and rain, and I even got an earthquake. Dr. Sagan went quiet for a second and asked if I could close the door. He then went on to describe a project he was working on, creating a record like a vinyl LP, but this one would be gold-plated. It would contain sounds of Earth and be placed on the Voyager spacecraft that would soon be launched and find their way out of our solar system. And could I send whatever sounds I had, send a copy of my tape to Annie, he said. Annie is, of course, Andrean, who with Dr. Frank Drake, Carl Sagan, and a small team of artists and scientists, we're rushing to create this golden record in time for the launch of the two spacecraft later that year, 1977. And after jaunts past Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, the Voyagers would go where no spacecraft had gone before, to interstellar space. NASA asked, would Sagan and his team create a message to send to the stars for anybody who or anything that might be able to pick up that record? The result of that question is one of the most storied objects in space history, the Golden Record. Part time capsule, part interstellar greeting, the record contains the story of Earth and of us. And among its contents are a diagram of DNA, a stellar map of Earth's position in the cosmos, and the music of Louis Armstrong, and also the sound of a kiss. Over the next 3 weeks, Science Friday is celebrating the legacy of the Golden Record, and we're asking you, what would you include on an updated Golden Record? We're collecting your suggestions at sciencefriday.com/Golden Record, and in 3 weeks, we'll present your revamped record right here on the program. But first, we're going to take a look back at the Golden Record's history with two of the people who helped create it. Andrean was the creative director for the Golden Record project. She co-wrote Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, with her late husband Carl Sagan, and was awarded the Emmy and Peabody Awards for Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. She joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome back to Science Friday, Anne.
Ira, it's always so great to be with you, and thanks for that impeccable introduction to the record.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I understand, is that a kiss was part of your experience on that record?
Yes, well, the idea was a kiss to last a billion years, you know. The shelf life of the record itself was said back then to be a billion years. I think now people think it would last even longer. And of course, the same people who gave it that shelf life were the people who designed and built the spacecraft, which of course exceeded every design specification or wildest expectation. So yes, I was involved in that kiss, and it's very hard to do a kiss that would sound like a kiss. Some of the best kisses don't sound that great. So yeah. I was involved in that.
I'm going to ask a little more for the details later, but after I introduce Frank Drake, a legendary astronomer and astrophysicist, his Drake equation estimates the number of communicative intelligent civilizations in our galaxy, and he was responsible for the picture sequence on the Golden Record. He joins us today from Santa Cruz. Welcome back, Dr. Drake.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk about the genesis of the record and the sounds and the photos that were on there. Let's start at the beginning. How did each of you get involved in the record project? Frank, tell it. You begin.
The roots of this go back before the record to a previous thing we sent into space, which was a plaque on the Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 spacecraft. NASA asked Carl, at the time those were about to be launched, to think of a possibility of putting a message on it. And he came to me and we talked about it. We were colleagues all the time in those days. And I suggested we do a plaque with certain things drawn on it, including a map using pulsars to show the location of the Earth with respect to other places in the galaxy. The result was that plaque, and it was a very simple thing with a few crude sketches of human beings on it and other things. But that created a great deal of interest. So a year or two later, when it came time to launch the Voyagers, NASA said, hey, we want to do that again. And they went back to Carl and said, well, can you put a message on the Voyagers? Well, we happened to be vacationing together at the time in Hawaii, and we sat down and thought about, well, what should we do? Should we send another plaque? And I suggested that a better thing would be a phonograph record because it could contain much more information as well as sounds and music and good images. So that is how it started, and from that grew the project to create the record.
And how did you get involved?
Around the end of 1976, Carl came to Tim Ferriss and me, and we had worked together on a previous project, which would have been a kind of Cosmos for Kids for the Children's Television Workshop. Well, that project never came to fruition, but we realized that the four of us, including Linda Salzman-Sagan, just had a chemistry for creative work, and so I think after his conversation with Frank, Carl came to us and asked us if we would like to participate. And of course, we were overwhelmed by this kind of sacred task to confer the closest thing to immortality that we humans have yet to touch on the music and the images and what it was like to be alive, to put that all in a message to other beings and certainly other worlds and times.
There's so much to choose from. How did you choose? How did you choose what got on the record?
Well, we had a lot of help. We went to composers, ethnomusicologists. We went to the great Alan Lomax, who was actually responsible for the inclusion of Louis Armstrong's just brilliant Melancholy Blues and much else on the record. And I mean, we knew how ignorant we were about other kinds of music, for instance, Chinese and Indian music, what arrogance it would be for us to pretend that we could make that selection in those other traditions. And so we went to the people who we thought could help us the best. And I look back on the 27 pieces of music, and I have to say, while there's been great music made since, I feel very, very pleased with what we managed to include.
I know you're a music buff, and you had certain ideas about what music had to be on the record. We're going to hear one of those tracks, and then I'll ask you to explain what it is. And can you tell us what that is?
I'm so moved to hear it. Yes, many years before we began this wonderful task of finding the music for Voyager, my dear friend Jonathan Cott invited me to listen to a recording by the Vague Quartet of the Cavatina movement of Beethoven's late quartet, Opus 130. And when I heard it, the first thing I thought of was, what can I ever do to repay Beethoven for what Beethoven has just given me? And so when Carl first proposed the project, the first thing I thought of was, hey, here's my chance to do a solid for Beethoven. And in researching the story of the late quartets, I found that Beethoven had written, of course, in German, in the marginalia of one of the compositions. What will they think of my music on the star of Urania? And so I think he was talking about Uranus recently discovered. And so he'd had that thought. And in another place in the margin, he wrote the German word Sehnsucht, which means longing. And that captured for me exactly what Voyager was all about, this longing to make contact with other intelligences in the universe, to know if we are alone or if there are others who think about and wonder about us. And so that was the first piece that was committed, that we committed to on Voyager.
Frank Drake, many people might not realize that there are pictures on this record, 116 of them. How do you put pictures on a phonograph record?
Well, you take the picture and scan it with a TV camera. A TV camera turns a picture into a long oscillating waveform, which is what is sent to the TV set. Well, you can do the same thing with sound. Sound is done in the same way as pictures are. And so the idea was to take the pictures and put them into the form of a TV transmission and record that on the golden record. Now, my original calculation told me like we could only put about 10 pictures. We could only fit that many on the record in addition to all the music and other things. It turned out that was wrong. We could put a total of about 112. And so we had the goal of picking the 112 pictures which best depicted life on Earth, our culture, our technology, our physiology, and all of that. That's not many pictures, so it was a very hard task to do. In addition, NASA asked us to add 5 more pictures, which were political, surprisingly. They were a list of the members of the congressional committees in the House and Senate who appropriate money to NASA. And we were to put on those pictures with the names in English text. And, of course, we've always wondered ever since, what are the extraterrestrials going to make of that?
Now, you got a little pushback. You've got pictures of our anatomy on the plaque, on the record, but you had a little bit of trouble in getting the pictures you really wanted to put on there. You had to settle for something else, right?
Oh, that's right. There were some very interesting challenges put to us, which was mainly not to offend anybody. So we started out wanting to give a totally realistic and comprehensive picture of life on Earth and of us, including all our physiology. NASA got very nervous because that implied we were going to have pictures of naked people and parts of naked people on the record, and they knew that could create a big public outroar. So we were instructed to have no nudity on the record, and also not to have any picture which depicted a religion, because they realized that putting any religion was going to antagonize people of other religions whose picture are not included. So there were several taboos, religion, naked people. We did, in fact, find what we thought was an acceptable picture of a naked human. It was a picture of a pregnant woman, but even that was not allowed by NASA. And the other thing they told us was that when we put in the detailed pictures of the human anatomy, all the various parts of our body, which there are about 12 pictures, we came to the pictures of genitals, and they told us, you may not construct a special picture for use on the record. You've got to take a picture out of a textbook, because that way NASA can't be blamed for transmitting pictures of nudity to the universe. They just didn't want smut to the universe, as some people were accusing them of doing. And so we took a picture out of a textbook and made that the picture which shows that part of human anatomy. And I've always thought that was going to be kind of a puzzle to the extraterrestrials, too, because all the parts on the picture are labeled in English text. And, of course, they won't know what that means. And this will be one of the great challenges to their linguists to figure all this out.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Frank Drake and with Andrean about the golden record. How did you get it together? The record, you had, what, 9 months to get the whole thing together, Anne?
Actually, I think it was more like six because, of course, everything on the spacecraft was being sterilized, and it had to be loaded onto the spacecraft, I believe, as early, very early, months before the first August 20th and September 5th launches of the spacecraft. And so I think we had just until sometime like mid-June. And then we were done. And so we had about 6 months. We, the entire record project, which was a full-time job, I think, for most of us, the entire record cost the taxpayers $18,000. And because every one of us were so inspired by the prospect of doing this, nobody wanted anything but that chance to touch forever. And so it was very hectic. There were all-night meetings about, should we just put our best foot forward? Do we elide over Auschwitz and Hiroshima and some of the things we've done that cause us shame? Should we be honest about how many people on this planet at that time were dying of the lack of potable water or shelter? And so we had the most fantastic, lively philosophical debates. And in the end, I think Carl's dictum that the spacecraft itself would certainly tell the extraterrestrials of our dreams that how sophisticated we were and at what level of technological adolescence we still were would probably reveal a lot more. Right. Than anything we could possibly hide or say.
We're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we'll come back and talk lots more about the golden record history with Frank Drake and Andrean. And you can take a second to explore the record for yourself. You want to see the scientific coding Everything else on there, go to sciencefriday.com and immerse yourself in our newest video, The Golden Record Decoded. It's our first 360 virtual reality video, so you can scroll and swipe and swivel through the video right on your desktop where you have a Google Cardboard, a virtual reality headset. You can get it on there in full 3D. Head over to sciencefriday.com/goldenrecord. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the Voyager Golden Record with two of its creators. In 1977, Andrian and Frank Drake helped Carl Sagan create a message to extraterrestrials, a golden record that contained music and scientific formulas, pictures, greetings in 55 languages. And here now they are to talk with us about it. I'm going to play a bit of the Golden Record sound essay called Sounds of Earth, because this track has sounds from both of you. We're going to hear a sound like firecrackers going off, and then there's something that sounds kind of like clapping. Wow. And I know that first sound is very special for you. Explain what that firecracker sound is.
Well, I asked Carl if it were possible, if I were to meditate for an hour while I was hooked up to a computer that was reporting all of the EKG, my heart, my electroencephalogram, my brain waves, rapid eye movement, every single signal that my body was giving out, would it be possible for the extraterrestrials of a distant future to decrypt what I was thinking? And I remember his beautiful smile, and he looked at me and he said, well, a billion years is a long time, Annie. Go do it. So I went to, with Tim Ferriss's help, went to NYU Medical Center in New York, and I remember the computer in those days was the size of a large bedroom. And today, probably, your phone probably has more computing power than this apparatus had. And I meditated for an hour. Well, as life would have it, this was 2 days after Carl and I had declared our love for each other in a phone call. And we'd known each other for years, but the subject had never come up before. And here I was, a young woman, the beautiful spring of 1977, June, feeling as alive and as ecstatic as I think anybody could feel. And so I tried not to be selfish. I tried to relate the story of our planet and the story of life on this planet, as well as the human species, and to confine myself to those, to a kind of mental itinerary. But of course, I was a woman newly fallen, madly in true love. And I remember how I felt, because I still feel that way for Carl. Mm. And so when I look back on it and realize that this most intimate message within the message, within this great many-layered palimpsest of the Voyager record, is at its heart the joy, the really the greatest joy of being alive, it just makes me feel so good. Mm.
Frank, do you have any idea of what the chances of any life form discovering the Voyager? I mean, it's already entered American culture, isn't it? Isn't part of one of the Star Trek movies, the V'ger, and someone picks it up and out of it?
The first Star Trek movie was about the discovery of the record. That's the basis of the whole movie. So, yes, it's already played a role in the construction of movies. The chances of it ever being captured are very small, to be honest. It's moving at about 10 kilometers a second. It's going to take it hundreds of thousands of years to approach another star, and it will not approach it very closely. So it will only be a civilization with its very sophisticated equipment, powerful radars that might find this and perhaps go out and capture it and explore what's on it. So in a way, it's our goodbye message to the universe. This is going to persist as a readable, decipherable record of us for literally billions of years, beyond the time when our sun expands and swallows up the Earth. It's going to last beyond the lifetime of mankind as we know it now. So in a way, it's our going away message. At the same time, it is a message to us in that it tells us what we might find, what might come to our system, either in the form of a record or in the form of a radio message. It just alerts us to the fact that messages, meaningful messages describing other worlds and the creatures on them, can be sent across the stars, between the stars, in a form which can be captured and understood.
Hey, a tweet from Phil Kalina, who says, was the record sent with clues on how fast to play it? And in general, are there instructions on there on what to do with the record?
Yes, there is an instruction book we sent with it. It's on the cover. The record is in a box, on the two Voyager spacecraft. And on the box are diagrams which tell you that you rotate the record at a certain speed, that you read it from outside in, because that's, of course, is the convention we use, but there's nothing magic about that. And also, it shows you the first message, or the first picture, which is on the record, which is actually just a circle. And that was put on because it allows the civilization that's decoding it to recognize that it has done the right thing. When it does the right thing, it's going to see a circle, and it's found the right way to decode the record. See, there are little puzzles like, what's the horizontal to vertical ratio of the pictures? You can only describe that by actually sending one of the pictures. We did send a sufficient instruction set to allow the record to be decoded and read.
Did you also, I understand, send a needle to play it also?
Yes, we sent not just a needle, we sent a whole pickup.
The stylus.
Yeah, the whole stylus with the electronics, which transfers the information from the stylus to an electrical wave.
Mm-hmm. On that little bit of tape I played before with the brain waves, there was a pulsar on the end of that, was it not?
Yes, you're very smart. You recognize the sound of a pulsar. Not many people know that. That is the sound that one hears if one takes the radio emission of objects from which we call pulsars and convert them to sound. They don't send sound, they send radio pulses. And they're one of the most bizarre and wonderful objects we have discovered in the universe. What they are rotating stars which were like our sun but have collapsed into an object which is about 10 miles in diameter. It's actually just bulk nuclear matter with enormous densities, 100 trillion times the density of matter on Earth. And they spin at a rate of once a second, and some of them in thousandths of a second, they do a complete rotation. And every time they rotate, they send out a pulse of radio emission, which makes a pulse. And that's what produced the sounds that you heard from the record. And it is on the record to show that we have discovered them. And the fact that we have discovered them gives some kind of measure of the prowess of our technology.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're asking our listeners and our social community to come up with ideas for if they were to make the record now, what things they would put on it. Andreen, if you had a chance to do it all over again now, are there things about the record that you would change?
There's nothing about the record that I would remove. Possibly Kurt Waldheim's address as Secretary of the United Nations back then, which was foisted upon us for political reasons, as Frank mentioned earlier. But I've often thought that if there was one other piece of music that I could add, I would certainly pick Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry. And that's just because I've been listening to it my whole life. And it's a song of community and of the reality of life. And it continues to move me, never loses its pull. And so I would have added that one. But as I said earlier, I'm very proud of what we did include.
I'm going to play another little bit that I know is one of your favorite non-negotiable tracks that was included. And you decided that Chuck Berry had to go to the stars?
Yes, I did. Excuse me. Yes, I did, because, first of all, at that moment in 1977, rock and roll was the most popular music on earth. And I was militant about the idea that a progenitor of this music should be on the record rather than the huge number of derivative artists who had learned from Chuck Berry. I picked him because he was not only a music virtuoso and an inventor of guitar riffs that people still use, but also because I think he's one of the great American novelists. He was a man who could tell a story that had meaning, nuance, particularity, in the brief passage of a song. And he told me much later that he first learned about its inclusion on the Voyager record when at a low point in his life, and it became the high point because of that fact that his music will live on. Another passage on the record, of course, is "Dark Was the Night" by Blind Willie Johnson. And those are, with Louis Armstrong and Chuck Berry, those are the three American artists on the record. Mm-hmm. And we felt that between them, they summed up America's musical gift to the world at that time.
Interesting. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Andrean and Frank Drake about the Golden Record, when we're asking everybody to come up with their ideas for a new Golden Record over the next few weeks. Frank, is there anything that you would put on the record that you might have left off or do something differently?
You're asking a very challenging question, because you might think that we would be able to put much more information on a new message, and you would be exactly right, but it's very hard to underestimate what the situation is. In 1977, the best thing we had was the old vinyl records. And they could take an hour of music and 100 television-quality pictures. Today, we have DVDs and CDs. And a DVD, for example, can carry as much information as 1,000 Golden Records. In a device which is much smaller than a vinyl record. You can go to your nearby electronics store and buy a tiny solid-state memory with a terabyte, that's 1,000 gigabytes of memory on it. That's equivalent to about 1,000 Golden Records for about $100, and it's the size of an old cassette recording. Of course, if you send that, you need to send something that can play it, and we all own those. We carry them around in our pockets. Our cell phones can read those memories. So the next message could be something equivalent to a cell phone and one of those off-the-shelf terabyte memories. So what does it do? It tells us, boy, we can put 1,000 records on that thing. And instead of making life easy, as you would think, it makes it very challenging. How do you sort out and decide what's the best thing to do when you have that much capacity. You could send the whole Encyclopedia Britannica with no problem at all. Should you do that, or should you be more choosy? Should you send videos? Just what should you send? Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a question that has to be answered by a huge number of people working together. And in fact, there's talk of doing that right now. Well, nothing's being done, but there's talk of proceeding with this and assembling a large number of experts who will put together the answer to that question you asked. And I'm not going to give you my answer, Erica, because there's just so much you can say that it would take me a half hour to tell you all the things you can put on the record now.
Is there a spacecraft you would put it on that's under development?
Haven't even thought about that.
You're thinking about a little microchip on a record, I thought, but on a spacecraft.
The whole device would be the size of a cell phone, so it right. can go on almost any spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. And what are your hopes for the Golden Record over the next 40 years? And I got about a minute for you to answer that.
Over the next 40 years? Well, you know, I don't think anything will happen to it over the next 40 years in terms of our putative extraterrestrials. But my hope is that we will, on this planet, begin to develop a degree of self-awareness, of self-consciousness. You know, the Voyager record had two intended recipients, these extraterrestrials, but also the people of Earth, to see ourselves as one organism capable of creating multiple kinds of beauty. And I guess my fondest hope is that we'll awaken to that fact and begin to treat each other, as Carl said so eloquently, as residents of a tiny pale blue dot.
Andre and Frank Drake, thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and happy celebration 40th anniversary of your upcoming record. Our Golden Record celebration here is going to continue over the next 3 weeks. We're asking you, what would you include on a Golden Record to alien civilizations? It can be a picture, a song, a piece of poetry, a mathematical equation. There are no limits, and we want you to submit your pick at sciencefriday.com/goldenrecord. We'll be presenting your record here on the show October 7th. Also, if you're in the New York City area, join us September 27th at Green Space at WNYC. We're going to listen to the live music from the Golden Record, hear what a panel of cultural commentators would put on the Golden Record 2.0, folks from Studio 360, WQXR, and Brain Pickings live at the Green Space September 27th. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com for details. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.